from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview from the archives with the author Eowyn Ivey about her 2012 novel, The Snow Child. Eowyn Ivey was raised in Alaska and continues to live there with her husband and two daughters. She worked for nearly a decade as a bookseller at Independent Fireside Books in Palmer, Alaska, and prior to that as a reporter for the local newspaper, The Frontiersman. Her novel, To the Bright Edge of the World, came out in 2016. I also subsequently spoke to her about that book. Her debut novel, the one we spoke about for this interview, is The Snow Child, which was a New York Times bestseller published in more than 25 languages. It was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, a UK National Book Award winner, an Indies Choice Award for debut fiction, and a PNBA Book Award winner. Eowyn Ivey's essays and short fiction have appeared in London's Observer Magazine, Sunday Times Magazine, Sunday Express Magazine, Woman and Home Magazine, the anthology called Cold Flashes, the North Pacific Rim Literary Journal, CIRC, Five Chapters, and Alaska Magazine. In Eowyn Ivey's debut novel, The Snow Child, a couple creates a child out of snow. When she appears on their doorstep as a little girl, wild and secretive, their lives are changed forever. When I spoke with Eowyn Ivey in 2012, we began with her reading a short excerpt from the book. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Jack came to a log and made a half-hearted attempt to brush the snow away before sitting on it. He laid the rifle across his knees, took off his wool hat, and ran his fingers through his hair. For some time, he sat bent over, his elbows on the rifle, head in his hands. Doubt crouched over his shoulder, ready to take him by the throat, whispering in his ear, "You are an old man, an old, old man." If he were to fall dead in these woods, nothing would rush to his aid. The north wind would blow down from the glacier, the ground would stay frozen, and a red fox like the one he had looked in the eye might be the first to sniff at his dead body and take a nibble here and there. The ravens and magpies would come to tear away at his frozen flesh. Maybe a pack of wolves would eventually find its way to his carcass, and soon he'd be nothing but a strewn pile of bones. His only hope would be Mabel, but then he thought of her struggling under his dead weight. He stood and shouldered his rifle. He had only cried a few times in his adult life, when his mother died, and when he and Mabel lost that little baby. He wouldn't let himself now. He put one foot in front of the other, and walked without seeing or feeling. It was the quiet that pulled him out of his gloom, a quiet full of presence. He brought his head up. It was the child. She was before him, just a few yards away. She stood atop the snow, arms at her sides, the hint of a smile at her pale lips. White fur trimmed her coat and leather boots. Her face was framed by the bell velvety brown of a sable hat, and she wore Mabel's red scarf and mittens. The child was dusted in crystals of ice, as if she had just walked through a snowstorm or spent a brilliantly cold night outdoors. Jack would have spoken to her, but for her eyes, the broken blue of river ice, glacial crevasses, moonlight, they held him. She blinked, her blonde lashes glittering with frost, and darted away. "Wait," he called. He stumbled after her. "Wait, don't be afraid." He was clumsy, tripping over his own boots and kicking up snow. She sprinted ahead, but stopped often to look back at him. "Please," he called again, "wait." A sound came to Jack's ears, like wind stirring dried leaves, or snow blowing across ice, or maybe a whisper from far away. "Shh." He did not call out again. He ducked beneath the tree branches and waded through snow as the girl led him farther and farther into the forest. He had to watch his feet to keep from tripping, but each time he looked up, she was waiting, and then she wasn't. He stopped, squinted and scanned the snow for her tracks. He saw no sign. Once again, he became aware of the quiet, the strange calm of the forest.
Thank you very much for reading that. I love that section of the book. It's something that happens a few times early on in the book, is that you lend this sense of mystery to to the environment that Mabel and Jack are living in. And I won't say what happens right after that scene that you just read, but something important does happen. And this is something else that you write right after that. He wanted to celebrate, but he was alone. The woods had a solemn air, and beneath the thrill in his own chest, there was something else. It wasn't guilt or regret. It was trickier. You know, and it was like, you always have this way of bringing us into a character in a very subtle but mysterious way, and it helps lead the reader into this kind of otherness of their world, and I just loved that. So
that was a
great section to read. So let's talk a little bit about what was your inspiration for writing The Snow Child.
Yeah, I work at a bookstore up here in Alaska, and it's such a fun place to work because we have both new and used books. And so you kind of just never know what you're going to come across. When I'm shelving books, often I kind of, you know, flip through them real quick. And one evening several years ago, it was a winter evening and dark outside, and I was shelving in the children's section, and I came across this little paperback, just very slim, children's book called The Snow Child, actually, and it was illustrated by an Alaskan artist named Barbara LaValle. So I read it just standing there at the shelves, and it was a retelling of the Snegorochka fairy tale. And it was kind of right then. It was a really odd sensation, actually. I got all tingly all over, and I thought, this is it. And the terrible thing is I had been working on a completely different novel for almost 5 years, and I was probably about three quarters of the way done with it. So for a long time, a few weeks, actually, if I confess, I tried to resist this new idea because I felt like, gosh, I got to finish this novel. And then eventually I couldn't do it. I was so excited about this new idea, so I shoved the other one in the proverbial closet and started researching Snegorochka.
Okay, now Snegorochka is, go ahead and tell us that.
Sure, Snegorochka is a Russian fairy tale. That's kind of what I found out as I started doing the research that I was completely unaware of. Is it has a very long history in Russia. Mm-hmm. There are beautiful lacquer paintings, Russian lacquer paintings on boxes, oil paintings. There's been a ballet, an opera, many retellings of it. And it was just kind of a revelation to me because I had never heard of it, and it was a fairy tale that could be set in my own backyard. And
yeah.
It was just really an exciting discovery for me.
Right. Now, the epigraph that you use in The Snow Child is from The Little Daughter of the Snow by Arthur Ransom. So is that a retelling of the...
It is. Yeah, and I'm thinking, I'm going to mess it up. I think it was in the 1800s that he did an English... I believe it was one of the first English translations of the fairy tale. And it was one that I stumbled upon as I was doing the research, and I think is probably the most well-known version of it. I've certainly seen references to it since then. And it's a little more of an extended one, like say from the one that I read in the children's book.
Okay. Now, in your book, your main characters are Jack and Mabel, and they are a couple in their early 50s, late 40s, early 50s, living in Alaska, sort of out in the middle of nowhere in Alaska in 1920, or in the 1920s. So, and then at one point in the book, Mabel receives from her sister a copy of a book that she remembered as a child, that she'd asked her to send her. So is that supposed to be something originally from Russia that is, I'm not going to say the name correctly.
Yes, Snegorochka. Yeah, and somewhere online I discovered, and it's the weirdest thing because I've never been able to track it down again, but I found some images of a Russian version of the book. With these beautiful illustrations, they were just the colors were really rich, and it was all in Russian. And it was just an odd experience for me to see that on the screen. And then, of course, I've never been able to track it down again. I'm not sure how I found it when I was researching online.
Oh, okay.
It was a Russian version of it. But you know, the nice thing about fiction is that I don't feel overly tied to my research. Well, in ways I do. In terms of things having to do with Alaska, I feel really strongly that I want the facts to be right, and maybe this is sort of arbitrary for me. I like to make sure I know that kind of tree grows here or that kind of animal lives here. But in terms of the things to do with the fairy tale, I felt like it was a lot of inspiration. For example, Arthur Ransom plays a very small part in the story, mm-hmm. but he didn't go to university in Pennsylvania. He had none of those connections. Mm-hmm. But I felt like, you know, he was such a minor character, and I kind of manipulated the way I wanted to.
Okay. Well, and it also seems like the original fairy tale would have been maybe passed along through oral tradition, and so you kind of can play with it a little bit.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think in ways it's similar. There's a lot of fairy tales like that that have just been retold so many different ways with many different endings, so I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about Mabel. The very opening of the book, there's this couple of sentences. Mabel had known there would be silence. That was the point after all. No infants. And then it goes on from there. And it's this very wonderful, quiet opening to explain to us sort of where her focus is and what she's been going through, which is that she's not been able to have a child. She did lose a child, but she doesn't have any children, and she's getting to be too old now. So that's her sadness and her great concern, and she and her husband are out in Alaska. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about developing Mabel and Jack as characters, and you kind of start them out in a really dire place emotionally, and I thought that was an interesting way to start the book, and I wonder if you can just talk about that a little bit.
Sure. Well, there are a couple things. I mean, one is really the fairy tale starts out that way. I think there's a lot of versions that say, you know, they were content in life except for one great sorrow.
Right.
And so a part of it was kind of developing that great sorrow and trying to understand. First of all, I have two daughters, and I'm very fortunate that I wanted to have children and I was able to have children. And so part of my my process was trying to imagine what would it be like if I really, really wanted a child and hadn't been able to have one. So part of it was trying to identify with Jack and Mabel's experiences on that level. But another part of it for me was to try to imagine what it would be like to be in Alaska for the first time as an adult and to be miserable here. Because I love it here, and I grew up here. And so it was really kind of fun to try to see it through an outsider's eyes and try to find out how could they fall in love with it? Could they come to appreciate it the way I do? So those were kind of the starting ground for me to try to understand them as characters a little bit.
Yeah. I thought one of the wonderful things about them and this period in their lives and being in Alaska was just that their isolation from other people and occasionally their isolation from each other, and it becomes very complex, and it takes on so much importance, and some things feel very threatening to them as individuals, and some things feel threatening to them as a couple. I don't know, and it felt like Alaska really provided this wonderful backdrop for all the complicated emotional stuff that's going on in the book.
And I do think Alaska is kind of an interesting place because there are, you know, growing up here, I saw that there were many people who came here, who have come here, wanting to be out in the middle of nowhere and be isolated. And I think that, just like anything else, it's more complicated than that. And I think spending a lot of time out in the middle of nowhere has its wonderful aspects to it. There's a certain peace that comes with it. But there is a loneliness. Mm-hmm. And so that was another element of it that I was trying to imagine, you know, what would be that, would that be like to think that what you want is solitude, and then to discover maybe it isn't entirely what you want.
Right. Now, is your area where you live, is that very remote, or are you in a town? Or?
Well, you know, it's so funny because it's so relative. Here in Alaska, many people would say, well, you live on the road system. We're a half-hour drive away from a city of about 5,000, mm-hmm. about an hour and a half away from Anchorage. So in those ways, it compared to many other people in Alaska who you can only access their home through snow machine or airplane, we're kind of, you could almost call it the suburbs or something.
Yeah.
But I think compared to most people outside of Alaska, when they come to visit us, they're, wow, you're out in the middle of nowhere. We live on about 20 acres on a dirt road. From our house, we can't see any other houses. And there's just beautiful wilderness all around us. And, you know, we always, throughout the winter, we have lots of moose in our yard, and during the summer, bears. And so we've had, you know, it's definitely out in the woods compared to most people's standards, I think.
And you've lived in Alaska most of your life, is that right?
Right. I was born in Denver, but my parents moved up here to Alaska when I was about 3 or 4. So pretty much my whole memory life is in Alaska.
Okay. So did you find, as you wrote this book, you had to do a lot of research on parts that you weren't familiar with about living in Alaska and perhaps hunting and all that? Or did you already have a really nice, firm hold on all of that?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I didn't have to do much research in terms of some aspects of it, things like you know, what's it like to hunt a moose in Butcher? That's something we do every fall. We raise chickens, we have a vegetable garden, and we pick berries. And so some of those things were just very much a part of my lifestyle, which is what I enjoyed about writing, why I enjoyed, I think, an aspect of it I really enjoyed writing, because it was just sort of delving into what I love about living in Alaska. But then there were other things I didn't want to mess up facts like, and silly things like, did they have strike matches back at 1920?
Right.
And so I was trying to be careful about the type of fabric they would have or things like that. And the internet is such a wonderful resource for that because you don't have to, I didn't have to slow my pace down a whole lot to make sure I had some of those littler facts. Hopefully, right.
One thing that I love about the book is the sense of mystery and fantasy that are all mixed in, and also the possibility of a person going mad living alone in the wilderness in Alaska through the winter, and how much of a threat that feels like. And one thing that you say early on is from Mabel. All her life she had believed in something more, in the mystery that shape-shifted at the edge of her senses, which is wonderful because it sets up something about the world, but it also sets up something about Mabel, you know? And it allows us to kind of question what comes next, to, you know, what's happening, you know, is this really happening, you know? And then I feel like that little bit that I read that followed what you had read about Jack, you know, feeling something trickier than what he could explain. It's a little bit of that too, you know, you do a lot of very subtle mixing in of the possibility of mystery or madness or fantasy. I thought that was really well done.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I think, you know, when I was a kid, I went through a phase of reading a lot of fantasy, and I enjoyed it, you know, things like David Eddings or Tolkien. But I think one of the things I always found disappointing is in the end, all the stuff was happening in other worlds. You know, these authors were creating these elaborate other worlds, and I always felt a little bit like, why can't it happen right here?
Right,
you know? And
right.
So it was kind of a way for me to play with that a little bit, but I did try to walk a line, I hope, of believability, and that maybe the idea that you could read the whole book and not believe in magic in it and still believe the story is what I tried to walk that thin line a little bit.
Well, we should talk a little bit about Faina, I think I'm saying. Is that correct? Is
yeah,
that
I believe
it?
So, yep.
She's the child who you mentioned in your reading, who sort of seems to live in the woods and comes and goes, and they see glimpses of her, and for a while they don't actually get to ever interact with her. And I loved the mystery of her and the fact that she shows up just after they build, or they, you know, put together a little snowman, a little snow child in their yard. But before they do that, I keep reading things that maybe I should let you read, but if I may, there's another paragraph that you, I just thought this was so beautiful. Up until now, Jack and Mabel have just sort of been really just barely getting by emotionally in their situation. And then one night it starts to snow, and Mabel's looking out through her window, and it says, as she watched, Jack walked out of the barn carrying a lantern, and the snow eddied around him in the circle of light. He turned his head as if he had sensed her eyes on him, and the two of them looked at each other across the distance, each in their own pocket of light, snow like a falling veil between them. Mabel couldn't remember the last time they had so deliberately gazed at each other, and the moment was like the snow, slow and drifting. That felt like such an important moment in the book, and it does just proceed with when they get to build this snow child in the yard. But what I really loved about that was the way that you kind of slowed down the narrative and infused that paragraph with such intensity through pacing. And I wondered if you can talk a little bit about pacing in a novel and the way that you use it to kind of echo what's happening in the narrative.
Sure. Yeah, it's such a... I don't know if you play a musical instrument or not, but when I was in high school, I played the violin, and I found that, you know, I would practice things and practice, and then once it came time to actually play something, I had to almost not think too much about what my fingers were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I find the same thing with writing. I think that I read a lot, and I think I must subconsciously kind of note, or, you know, I hope that I maybe subconsciously note what authors are doing with pacing, but honestly, it's not something I consciously think about when I'm writing at all. It's kind of by feel, and almost like a tightrope walk or something. If I think about it too much,
yep,
it might not work. And so it's funny that I don't think about it very much, to be honest, and it's more just by feel, I guess.
Yeah. Now, will you notice that something happened in a first draft and then maybe try to heighten it in your revision, or what's your
revision
process?
That's a really good question. I think that is true. And actually there were certainly moments that some of my first readers, my husband's one of my first readers and my mom, and they actually were really good at sort of seeing perhaps that something was more significant than I had made it, or just noticing, oh, that's a really interesting element. And then by having the assistance of someone else noticing something, then I could develop it more. And revision for me is just like this constant. It's not as if I wrote a first draft and then, okay, now I'll go back and revise. I was constantly revising as I went. And so I think that is a really good insight, but I think sometimes it's after you write it, then you realize, oh, wait a minute, that is an important scene, mm-hmm. or that does have an important element to it.
Yeah. Okay. So that particular moment that I just read back to you, do you remember writing that?
I do. I think the one thing that really stays with me, and it's a little bit revealing, but my husband and I have been together since we were teenagers. I think I was about 14 when we started dating. And later in that scene, she describes a dream that she has where she can fly when she and Jack first fall in love. And I had that dream when my husband and I were first dating. I had this dream that I was outside and I've never had a flying dream since then or before. And I think it was just being in love. And so that was that feeling that I tried to retell or to capture, mm-hmm. and to find in Jack and Mabel, because I wanted the idea that they do really love each other, and they always have, but they've just had such a hard time, and so trying to rediscover that first love a little bit.
Yeah, it was such a relief as a reader to get to that section, because, you know, you feel for them, and then all of a sudden they're having fun in this scene. You know, they have a little snowball fight, and they build a snowman, mm-hmm. and it's just a wonderful scene that you really do see their tenderness, which you've kind of sensed, but in this way, it's sort of the first scene in the book where the two of them together, you're not just in one person's head or the other, you're sort of watching the two of them together.
Interesting.
So they build this snow girl in the yard, and then, you know, eventually we come to meet Faina. I don't want to give too much away about the narrative, but I wonder if you can talk a little bit about developing Faina's character and how you went about creating this child.
Well, and that's interesting because when talking about revisions and really realizing things that are important and things, with her it was the exact opposite, in that when I first wrote her, began to develop her, I had a lot more information about her. I've got pages and pages that I actually ended up cutting because I realized with her I didn't want to reveal too much. I felt like that her mystery was part of her identity, mm-hmm. and that by, you know, developing her too much, I removed some of that. So she was, I think she was the most challenging character for me to write, but also the most fun in that way, because it was almost like sculpting away stuff to reveal a little more of her. And I guess I also, I felt like ultimately maybe I had to trust a reader more to be able to figure out who she really is. So it was a very interesting process with her, and that I knew a lot more than I, or it's funny because almost like I unknew it. I had all this stuff about her, and I thought, no, maybe that's not true, or maybe I don't want to know that about her. It wasn't just for the reader, but for my own sake, I think, that I cut a lot of things out.
Yeah, okay. All right, great. Well, one aspect of this book that I absolutely loved was these strong Alaskan women who Jack and Mabel encounter in their life. One is Betty, and one is Esther. I thought they were really great characters. And I was wondering, you know, like living in Alaska, do you feel like that a lot of the women who live in Alaska are just naturally kind of stronger, hardier people because they just sort of have to be?
Yeah. No, that's a great question. To be honest, I don't know if, like, statistically we have more great women like that, but certainly I'm drawn to them, and I admire them. And I do think that probably, I suspect that even during the time that, say, my parents moved up here, I think that Alaska is a place that requires a lot physically, a demanding place to live, especially if you're not living in the urban areas. So I think that it is a place that maybe attracts women who are a little tougher and like a physically challenging life. And I have certainly, Esther is her own character. I didn't make her after anybody specific, but certainly she had elements of lots of women in Alaska who I really admire, who just seem to be able to, we have up here in Alaska, I won't be able to think of the name of it, the Alaska, it's the wilderness Wilderness Woman Competition in Talkeetna, Alaska, where women have to go through an obstacle course and chop wood and haul water and do all these things, and it's a race. And I just always think, okay, that's the epitome of great Alaskan women.
yeah, absolutely. Now, how about you and your lifestyle? Are you very involved in all of the very active life on your land, or is that mostly your husband's job? Or
No, it's definitely something we do together. And I really think that I think that people who come to Alaska who end up hating it are people who don't really love the outdoors, who don't mm-hmm. want to get out. I think that's what really Alaska has to offer. And so I'm not sure that you can really love it here unless you do a lot of outdoors things. So yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's certainly chores that my husband's better at. I definitely chop wood, but he usually fells the trees, you know. And so we share a lot of the work together. When we get a moose together, we're both packing out the meat and butchering it ourselves. And so it's kind of a team effort that I really enjoy a lot.
Yeah. Well, since we're talking about the difference between men and women a little bit here, one scene that I really found so interesting was early on when we're learning a little bit more about Mabel and Jack's background and their childlessness. One way that we learn more about that is through a conversation between Jack and his friend George. And I never thought about this before I read your book, but I feel like most books that are talking about childlessness are all from the perspective of the women. And this was such a great moment in the book. Jack says, "Nope, never had any." And George says, "What's that? Never had any, you say? Nope." And Jack is watching George, and the narrative says, "If you said you didn't have children, it sounded like a choice, and what kind of craziness would that be? If you said you couldn't, the conversation turned awkward while they contemplated your manliness or your wife's health." Jack waited and swallowed. It was just this great tension between them in that moment, and then, of course, George saves it, and it's fine. But I really enjoyed that conversation happened between those two men.
No, I think that's a really great insight that I didn't consciously think about, but I do think that it's a very real thing for men too who want to have children. I was feeling like I want to make sure I state that, but certainly I know there are lots of people in the world who just choose to not have children and they don't want them, and I'm certainly not making the case that everyone's miserable who doesn't have children. But I think for a couple who really that is something that they want, I think it is just as difficult for the man and just maybe perhaps different ways.
Yeah, well, and I think too you're presenting this from a 1920 perspective, and so I think that probably society expected a different thing back then than now.
But although I do think that people still, you know, I certainly have known young married couples who haven't been able to have children have talked to me about the awkwardness of people mm-hmm. saying, "Oh, when's the first baby coming?" And I think it's a really painful thing for those who do want to have them and can't, and everyone wants to know when's the first baby coming, you know.
Yeah. No, it isn't. It's incredible what people will say.
Well, and I think without even realizing, you know, they just don't. Absolutely.
Right. From the perspective of a writer and writing fiction, I loved. There's this moment in the book that I thought was so great. Mabel has just met Esther and George, and Mabel comes to understand the differences between herself and Esther, and how those differences sort of make them see the world in different ways. And there's this thing you write that's Mabel realized she had never really studied the stove before, just as she knew that Esther had yet to notice the carefully set table or the few photographs hanging on the walls. It was as if she were seeing a different cabin altogether, which is great because it sets up some of the tension that might exist between these two friends in the book, and the way that they see the world differently. But it also struck me as this great explanation of writing point of view. You know, it's like, because you really have to think about how one person is going to look at this cabin versus how another person is going to look at this cabin.
That's a great insight. Yeah, I do love Esther. I mean, she really was a relief for me as well, you know, that not just for Mabel, but for me personally, because she just does see the world so differently. And I think, in a way, that's what enables them to be such great friends, you know, I think, is that they do see the world so differently.
Right. Yeah, the whole tone of the book changes when that family comes into their lives, and all of a sudden there's just a little bit more lightness. Faina often has a fox with her. I'm wondering, is that part of the original tale?
Well, there was just a little hint of it. I believe, as I recall, in the Arthur Ransom one, there's a version where the little girl gets lost in the woods, and all these different animals come to offer help to her, to bring her, find her way back home to the cottage where the old man and woman are, you know, and I believe it's a bear and a wolf, and the little girl's too frightened of these different animals, and she says, no, no, I'm not going to go with you. But then when a fox comes, she does go with him. And so I just, I think in one version it's described as, you know, she holds on to the ruff of his neck, the fur, and the fox leads her out of the woods. And I just love the idea of a little girl having a fox that's not quite a pet, but sort of a companion, a wild companion. Mm-hmm. And so that was sort of the seed that then I developed from there with the fox.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How much did you draw on the fairy tale, and how much did you kind of create your own fairy tale of all this?
I don't know, you know, and I've been asked, I've had readers ask me, you know, did I feel confined by the fairy tale, like did it hold me to some, you know, storyline, and I didn't feel that way at all. It was really fun, I think because I am an avid reader, for me it was really fun to sort of interact with these different versions of the fairy tale, sort of like Mabel does early on. She learns of different versions and she's sort of contemplating them, and so that was what it was like for me. And it becomes kind of blurred, to be honest. I read so many different versions and it was just sort of soaking it up, so there's little bits of lots of the different versions in there.
Yeah.
But of course, Jack and Mabel are their own people, and the characters start, which I never really understood that until I started writing fiction. I had certainly seen where authors said that the characters started running the show themselves, and I can kind of relate to that a little bit, that certainly the characters begin to dictate some of what happens.
Mm-hmm. Was there a sort of most challenging aspect for you about writing The Snow Child?
Like, I really do think that the only thing that felt really like a puzzle I had to figure out was Faina, in terms of both how much I reveal about her and then really trying to figure out who she was. I didn't, although I think in ways she sort of represents aspects of Alaska, I didn't want her to just be a symbol. I wanted her to feel like a real person.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was the challenge for me with her, was sort of trying to figure out how to develop her without making her too real. I think that was one of the reasons, ultimately, I don't know if you noticed, that because I've had some people say that they think it's a typo, I don't use quote marks when she's talking.
Yeah.
And that was something I kind of found along the way, because it felt too strange having her in these quote marks. It felt too hard and too grounded. And so there were little things like that I tried to do to create her the way I wanted to. But I definitely think that was probably the most challenging element of it.
Right. Well, and also when she first is in all the scenes and everything, there's just the sense of, is she really there? And so the fact that there were no quote marks, I loved that. I just sort of thought that added to the whole, like, I don't know what's going on.
So. Yeah, no, good, good. That's what I hoped. Wonderful.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your background, Eowyn. I know that you have a background in journalism. So I wondered, how has that helped you as a fiction writer, do you suppose?
Yeah, I think that it was a kind of a mixed blessing, to be honest. I have always loved to read and write. So when I went into college, it was me trying to figure out how can I make a living as a reader and a writer. And I didn't particularly want to teach, so I ended up switching to journalism because I thought, okay, here's a practical way that I can be a writer and make not a ton of money, but earn a little bit of a living. And so then I came home back up to Alaska. My husband and I were in Washington State for university, and we came back home to Alaska, and I got an internship at the local paper, and then eventually that developed into like a 9-year job. And I think it was fabulous in terms of just producing that amount of copy, writing that much. I think especially the small town newspaper, I mean, you're writing 6, 7, 8 stories every week. And there's definitely the sense that you can't be too sensitive or linger over your art too much. You've just got to get stuff done. And I was able, basically, the sky was the limit. I mean, I could write about anything I wanted to. Some things I had to do, you know, cover school board meetings or city meetings. But I was able to write a lot of outdoors columns about, you know, a hiking trip I went on or different things, feature stories where I was interviewing people. All that was great. But ultimately, it really wasn't the kind of writing I wanted to do, and mm-hmm. it took me perhaps a little too long to realize that. I think I don't know that it would have maybe been better if I had left sooner, but after about 9 years, I thought, okay, I don't have the time and the energy to write on my own when I work as a reporter. And so going to the bookstore was just the perfect answer, because it was the exact opposite. Instead of sucking energy out of me, it was just giving me so much inspiration and energy. So I think that was a really good move for me.
Yeah, and so now you still work in the bookstore. Are you planning to continue to work in the bookstore?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I'm taking time off right now. Just it's been a little crazy and wonderful crazy. I've been doing some travel. I was just in New Orleans and Denver, and then my UK publisher is bringing me over there.
London,
Scotland. Yeah, I'm very excited. My husband and I are going to go, and it'll be. I'm really looking forward to it. It's very exciting. So I am taking some time off now, but definitely I feel. Very much like a part of, you know, it sounds like such a cliche, but the Fireside Books family. I mean, it's a very small staff, and the owners are very much involved, and it's just a wonderful place to be a part of, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And so tell me the name of the store again.
Fireside Books, yeah. And it's one of, I mean, unfortunately, I don't know if you're seeing this where you're at, but lots of bookstores are closing up here. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so really, Fireside Books, I believe in our area, the Palma Wasilla area, is I think one of the only bookstores that carries new books. There's a couple used bookstores, but I think it's getting down there. So it's kind of a last holdout.
Yeah. I think it's funny. In Burlington, I'm in Burlington, Vermont, and in Burlington there was this wonderful bookstore downtown called Chasman and Bem, and for many, many years that was the place to go. And it was just a gorgeous, beautiful, locally owned bookstore.
Sure.
And they went out of business, and Borders came in, or right around the same time Borders came in. So now recently Borders has gone out of business, which was the main bookstore for new book purchases downtown. You know, there are used bookstores downtown. But and everybody seemed really confused about how to feel about that, because, of course, now we are lacking that resource. But we all sort of felt kind of negative when they came in and knocked out Chasman and Bem. So I was like, what's happening?
It is. That's a dilemma. And I just think it's a really odd time, both for publishing and for bookstores, that they're trying to figure out how is this whole thing going to work, you know. And like a lot of independent bookstores, we're now selling e-books through our website in cooperation with Google Books. But we just, you know, just trying to figure out how is this going to work. And it's it's a challenging time. And I really do think that in our community, if Fireside Books were to close, I think people would be really sad, because it's not just books. I mean, it's sort of a hub for artists and writers, and people in the community come in to talk about, you know, ideas, and it's sort of a unique atmosphere that way.
Yeah. How much do you work when you are working there? Are you
When I first started out, I was working full time, 40 hours a week for the first couple years, and then I got pregnant with my second daughter. And when I came back from her being born, I started working part time. And so I'm actually working very few hours now. You know, like 12, 15 hours a week, which is nice though, because then I could stay home with my young daughter.
Yeah, right. So how much time do you actually have to write?
Well, you know, looking back on when I wrote The Snow Child, I still sometimes wonder how I did it, because here we had a brand new baby in the house. My husband works full time; he's a fishery biologist. The house that we live in was just like a recreational cabin when we bought it, so we're building and working and finishing it as we live in it. And so what would happen is every evening after the baby went to sleep, I would just say, okay, quick, I've got to run up there. And it was almost like being on a deadline. I knew I had like an hour or two to write before I was just completely exhausted from the day. And so it was, in ways, I almost think maybe that's how I write best, is when I've got only a little sliver of time and I have to make it work for me. And right now, everything's a little topsy-turvy. I'm actually surprised at how much writing I'm doing having to do with The Snow Child, you know, where someone will ask for an essay or things like that, which is really fun, but it's not fiction writing. I'm not doing much of that at the moment.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So how long did it take you to write The Snow Child? I know you said you had another book in the works for 5 years before you started it.
Well, and that's a strange thing, is I had worked on that book for 5 years, and then when I got the idea for The Snow Child, really within about a year I had a first draft, a completed manuscript. And then I did end up, you know, working on it for about another, I'm trying to remember now if it was about maybe another year and a half of revisions and kind of fine-tuning it. So.
Mm-hmm.
Relatively quickly compared to my first one. And I have the funny thing about it is I have no idea how long it'll take me, you know, to write my next one. I don't know if it's going to come really fast like The Snow Child or be a longer struggle like my first one.
Right. Well, I think from what I've heard, once you've got a book that has been popular, your publisher is going to motivate you to be a little quicker.
Yeah, that hasn't happened yet, so I'm not sure. And it's such a funny thing, because I really felt, you know, somewhat prepared, having worked in the bookstore for so long. You know, we've had lots of authors come to the bookstore. We deal with the publishers. I felt like, okay, I've kind of got an understanding of how this whole process works, and everything about my experience has been completely contrary to everything I've heard. I'd always heard that people, authors, readers hate their covers and I love my cover. I had no idea that it would go be published in foreign countries before here. I thought that, you know, maybe somewhere down the road, if it did okay here in the United States, a foreign publisher might be interested. And instead, it's been already released other places. It's just been very surprising. So I take nothing for granted. I'm just kind of along for the ride at this point.
did a version release in Russia?
No, it's been so interesting. I mean, I have Lithuania and the Czech Republic and Slovakia, and I have not heard anything from Russia yet, which seems it does seem a little funny to me, just since it's based on a Russian fairy tale. So.
Yeah. What was, let's just talk a little bit about your publishing experience. You mentioned, you know, all of these different options that people have today in publishing, and so what was your experience like? With this?
It was just so not what I expected. How I met my agent, I didn't go through the normal query process. I wasn't even really looking for an agent when it happened. We have a conference up here called the Kachemak Bay Writers Conference, which is a really wonderful writing conference in Homer, Alaska. And they bring in, I'm trying to think of some of the people who have been there. They've had some great writers over the years, and they bring in editors and agents to present. And of course, you can sign up for these slots to pitch to the editors and agents. But I went to this conference I was about three quarters of the way done, I think, with the manuscript at that point. And I had no intention of pitching. I didn't feel like it was done. And I just wasn't really even thinking about publishing at that point. But my mom started encouraging me, you know, you should just go talk to him. And then when I saw that it was Jeff Klineman, I recognized several of his books, Finn, Art of Racing in the Rain, and I was pretty impressed. I thought, oh my gosh, he's in the big leagues, you know. And so my mom kept saying, oh, go on, what can it hurt? So I finally did, thinking, okay, well, maybe he'll give me some feedback as far as when the time comes, how is my pitch, you know, who could I be maybe pitching to? And instead he said, well, I'd like to see the first 100 pages. And I didn't have the manuscript with me because this wasn't my plan, you know, and I'm sure he must have been thinking, well, why didn't you read your manuscript? And so it ended up being this whole big rigmarole where my husband was outside at the time cutting wood, and so I couldn't get him on the phone, and the neighbors had to drive over and tell him, hey, you got to answer your phone. Anyone needs their manuscript faxed down. It was all craziness. And then continuing to be contrary to what I expected, the next morning at the conference, Jeff offered to represent it, and I
goodness
three bowled over. I literally had to sit down. It was giving me wobbly knees, you know. And then again, I thought, oh well, that's it then. You know, in the next month or two, it'll be sold. And instead, it was, you know, working with him on some revisions, and then him kind of waiting. Okay, when's a good time to start submitting to publishers? And then, of course, when Little Brown bought it, it simultaneously sold to a publisher in Germany and Italy and the UK, and I was just, wait a minute, this isn't what I expected. And then the editors I've worked with have just been so respectful and so fabulous and have never said, you need to get rid of this part of the storyline or you need to do it. It was just, well, what would you think about, you know, moving this chapter or doing this? And every time I just really respected their opinions, and I thought really made the book better. So it's all along the way, it feels a little bit like a dream. It's gone so well.
But you know what? It's wonderful because it sounds like it was a very organic book for you. You weren't trying to necessarily hit what's right in the market. I mean, it happened because it was meant for you to write this book. And yet, it sounds like it occurred to these people that this is a book that's going to be very well received right now just because of what people are looking for. So that's just all the stars lining up.
For me, that was a book that feels like it really does come from my heart. You know, it was something I did feel like this is a story that I can tell in a unique way to my lifestyle, my experiences. And so it was a very exciting thing. But it is such a funny, I see it a lot at the bookstore, that you just never know what's going to happen with a book. You know, a book that publishers really, really want to do well will just be ignored at the bookstore sometimes. Other times, quiet kind of books that I love, I have to, like, put them into my customers' hands and say, here, read this, you'll love it. So trends and marketing is just, to me, the biggest mystery of all.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's so personal, isn't it, what people like to read? So
it is. And, I, you know, that's one thing that's been, I think, really wonderful for me to work at the bookstore is that, you know, there are certain genres that I'm not particularly interested in, but I have a new appreciation for because I see how much joy people get out of reading their books. They're so excited to read the next one in the series or the new one by their favorite author. And so I don't at all feel like, everyone should be reading the same book or should have the same taste as me. And actually, it's funny, I always feel a little bit nervous when I know a friend or a relative is reading The Snow Child because I don't want them to feel like they have to say they like it. If they really don't enjoy it, it's okay. There are so many wonderful books out there, you know.
That's funny. Well, now that we're talking about what kind of books people like to read, what do you like to read, and what have you read lately that you've enjoyed, maybe?
Yeah, I do love to read. I feel like I'm a kid in a candy shop right now, because I get advanced reader copies at the bookstore. You know, of course, publishers send them, and I've discovered this new joy of being an author is that you also get advanced reader copies of books. So I get to read lots of great things. When I was getting ready to go to a dinner in New York City not long after my book sold, I got to be in a dinner with Chad Harbick, Luis Ureja, Ayad Akhtar, so American Dervish, Queen of America, and Arda Fielding. And this is when I realized I was naive to think that I would always be able to do this, but I actually read all the manuscripts before I went to the dinner. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to do that since I've just been so busy, but I read all three of them and just really enjoyed them a lot. And actually, Josh Bazell was there with his new one, Wild Thing. So it was just, and I read all his first one as well, Beat the Reaper. And it was just so exciting to read all those books. I don't know if you've had a chance to read any of them.
I read The Art of Fielding, and I love that, but I'm madly writing down your other ones here because I haven't read
those. Yeah, I really recommend. Yeah, Queen of America, Beat the Reaper. They're also different. Beat the Reaper is very funny and quirky and kind of this wild ride, and Queen of America is sort of this sweeping epic, and it's got a magical quality, too, with it, with a saint. And American Dervish, I think, is a really a kind of important book, looking at American-Muslim relations, and it's a very, very good book. So yeah, this is actually a dangerous question. I can go on and on. I just read, I reread The Housekeeper and the Professor. My book club did it. It's by a Japanese novelist. It's wonderful. I'm reading a nonfiction right now, Lions of the West by Robert Morgan. He wrote Gap Creek, which is one of my favorite novels. And Lions of the West is sort of, it's a history book. It's a nonfiction about some of the explorers in America. And it's a wonderful book, too.
So you said a minute ago that you're not doing a whole lot of writing right now because you're so busy. But what do you think you might be working on next?
Yeah, I actually am. I do have an idea in the works, and I'm partway into it. I was actually even fortunate enough to get a grant. The Rasmussen Foundation up here in Alaska is a fabulous organization that gives grants to artists of all different types. And so they gave me a grant this last summer. My husband and I floated almost 100-mile section of the Copper River up here in Alaska from Chitna to Cordova, which is on the ocean, for research for my next novel. I think it's going to share some similarities with A Snow Child. It's set in historical Alaska in the 1800s and also has some fantastical elements to it. But I'm imagining this to be a little more epic and adventurous, a bit of a bigger book in that way, maybe not quite so intimate. The raft trip was a fabulous way to kick it off. I thought, okay, well, so far I'm enjoying this book a lot.
Now, you didn't bring your kids on the raft trip, did you?
No,
did you?
We didn't. For a couple reasons. Our oldest daughter is 12, and she would have just been bored. and our youngest daughter is 4, and we would have been a little scared to have her on the raft on the Copper River. The Copper River is funny because it's not, there's not a lot of white water or anything. It's not that kind of a rafting trip, but it is a big, big, cold, fast river. People drown in it every year. It's a popular fishing river. You probably have heard of Copper River Reds. Mm-hmm. Copper River sockeye salmon are world famous salmon to eat.
Right.
And but it's a big scary river just in terms of its power. So no, just the two of us went just in a little raft. I think with a 14-foot inflatable raft, we were gone for about 5 days, and it was an amazing experience. I mean, we had glaciers calving around us and seals swimming up to the raft and brown bears on the shore, and it was just kind of once in a lifetime kind of a thing.
That's wonderful. How did you know how to do that? I mean, especially if he works
in
the fisheries.
I have to give all the credit to my husband. I mean, I'm a good camper. I know how to set up a tent and build a campfire. I do not know how to raft. And so originally we had actually thought about hiring some guides, but the people that we kind of knew and really trusted were booked up for the summer, and they know my husband. My husband runs the rivers a lot and motorboats as a biologist and a fisherman. But they said to Sam, you know rivers. You can do this fine. Just, you know, rent one of our rafts and do it that way. But then it was funny because once we got on the river, we were floating towards this kind of scary, it's called Salmon Point. It's this rocky point, and the water is just very quickly pulling us over there, and Sam's rowing madly, and he's like, yeah, maybe we should have gotten guys. I thought, oh dear, we're already committed, we can't go back now. But he does, he's an amazing outdoorsman, and he learns things fast and knows, is very safe and conscientious, and it ended up, I think it was actually a better experience, just the two of us going, because it was, you know, it was all on us to kind of figure everything out, and it was amazing. It was really a great trip.
That sounds wonderful. I wonder if, for writers who might be listening, if you can talk a little bit about writing in another time period. This book took place in the 1920s, and you say that you're going to be writing your next book in the, I guess, 19th century book in Alaska. So can you talk just a little bit about how you approach doing that?
Well, and it's funny with The Snow Child, because I've had a few people describe it as historical fiction, and for some reason I don't really think of it that way. I think because... that wasn't what drew me in. It wasn't that I wanted to tell a story set in 1920s Alaska. What happened is, when I discovered the fairy tale and I realized I wanted to tell the story, and Jack and Mabel's characters started to kind of come into my mind, I just realized I toyed with the idea of setting it in modern Alaska, and then I just realized it didn't have the right texture for me. That was kind of hard to explain, but I wanted oil lamps, and I wanted certain elements of it. And I realized, too, that it seemed very improbable that a little girl would be running around in the woods in modern-day Alaska, and there wouldn't be, like, search and rescue teams and authorities involved and things. So kind of just by practical and sort of aesthetics, it felt right. And my next one is kind of a new adventure for me. It is, I don't think there's any denying it's going to be a historical novel set in that time frame. And I am paranoid about getting things wrong. I want to make sure I'm not putting something in that couldn't have occurred in that time frame. And so I do think research is just, I mean, there's so much amazing online resources now to find out a lot of things. So that's a big part of what I did so far with my next novel, is a tremendous amount of research. I spent some time in the Anchorage Library reading journals from the time and different things like that to try to get a sense of the voice of the people at that time and things like that. But it's part of the fun. It's kind of a double-edged sword. Yeah, I have to make sure I don't get too much fun into the research, because it can be a little bit of a distraction from actually doing the writing.
Right, right. Now, will you be putting in any historical figures, or is it just...
No, and you know, I actually, what I'm going to do, there was a true life expedition up the Copper River in the 1800s that I kind of want to use as a jumping off point, sort of an inspiration for the story, but I don't want to use the people who actually did that expedition. I'm a little uncomfortable trying to get into the heads of people who were real people. I just, for some reason, that makes me a little nervous. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, I can just invent my own characters, and I will certainly use their real journey and try to, you know, get a little bit of feel for what it was like for them. But it'll be my own characters that I put on the adventure, I think.
Okay. All right. Great. Well, that sounds wonderful. I look forward to reading that one, too.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah. Well, so, Eowyn, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was very exciting.
This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. And that was an interview from 2012 with the author Eowyn Ivey. We discussed her then-new novel, The Snow Child, published by Little Brown & Company. And you can learn more about her work at eowynivey.com. You can also listen to my subsequent interview with her, which was about her second novel, To the Bright Edge of the World, which came out in 2016. You can find that on the podcast site. This week's Write the Book prompt is to consider fairy tales. This is a genre from which I'm sure Eowyn Ivey draws great inspiration. And this fall, CBS is airing a new show that takes classic fairy tales and turns them into present-day thrillers set in New York City. Thought that was interesting. And a lot of the contemporary fairy tales that we're familiar with draw on older fairy tales or even ancient fairy tales. An example of that is like Beauty and the Beast, which is a remaking of many, has been remade many times into lots of different iterations. So anyway, consider a tale that might be a favorite for you and think about how this story could inform your work. Perhaps the witch in Hansel and Gretel could help you develop your depiction of a person who works at a subway newsstand. Or maybe you see a hint of the ugly duckling's journey into adulthood when you work to recreate your childhood best friend in your memoir. Reread one of these stories and let it give you new ideas. Feel free as you work to recognize cultural cliches, which I think a lot of these fairy tales do have, and many of them may be now outdated. So, you know, feel free to play around and change things, you know, make the beast a woman, make beauty a man. Change things around, see how it comes out for you. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, as I say every week, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 993wbtv.org. Have a great week.